Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. My name is Paul Wirth, and I'm a host here at the New Books Network on the Eastern European Studies channel. And we have for you a really interesting discussion on this episode. We know a lot about the space race, that is the U.S.-Soviet competition in and over the cosmos, but a good deal less about space collaboration, when the two superpowers work together to solve technical problems and promote peace, such as a key assertion of a new book by Andrew Jenks, Collaboration in Space and the Search for Peace on Earth, forthcoming with Anthem Press in November of 2021. Professor Jenks recounts that the Apollo-Soyuz test project, a key program and catalyst for detente, marked the transition to a new age of space collaboration, which continued through the Soviet Intercosmos missions, the Mir shuttle dockings of the early 1990s, and on through the International Space Station. Europeans, Americans, and Russians envisioned space collaboration as a way to reconfigure political and international relations. Professor Jenks is no newcomer to issues about space technology and Russian and Soviet history. A professor at Cal State University in Long Beach, he's the author of numerous articles and several books, including Russia in a Box, Art and Identity in the Age of Revolution, published in 2005. The Perils of Progress, Environmental Disasters in the 20th Century, published in 2010, and The Cosmonaut Who Couldn't Stop Smiling, The Life and Legend of Yuri Gagarin, published in 2012. Professor Jenks is also an editor of a leading journal in Russian history, namely Critica, Explorations in Russian and Eurasian History. And I'm thrilled that he is here today to tell us about his book, Collaboration in Space. Welcome, Professor Jenks.
Thank you, Paul. This is really an honor to be able to speak about my book. And of course, we academics love to talk about our research. So thank you for that opportunity.
We do indeed. And I expect on that basis, we'll have a really interesting conversation. Let me start by trying to sketch out, or get you rather to sketch out a little bit about who the sort of the main players are in the story that you're telling. Who are the main protagonists? On the one hand, of course, we have the United States and the USSR, but should we be more specific about particular people, particular agencies, and were there other players to take note of in this process of space collaboration?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and it touches upon one of the things that really fascinated me in my research as I went through the archival sources, both the Russian ones and also in the case of the United States and the Nixon Library and elsewhere. And one of the things that struck me was the central role of some European players, in particular France. And, France's example of reaching across the ideological barriers of the Cold War in the 1960s under de Gaulle and his successors was actually an example that inspired Nixon to engage in his policy of détente. And I think one thing that the French did that in particular interested both Nixon and also Brezhnev and Kosygin is that France saw technology and science as a kind of neutral ground, supposedly, that could project relations between France and the Soviet Union to an area beyond ideology. In other words, it was a way to find a place where they could come together rather than thinking about the things that, ideologically speaking, that separated them. And so France engaged in a series of collaborative agreements beginning in 1966 that resulted in extensive cooperation between French physicists and scientists and also politicians and their Soviet counterparts. And that was something that was noticed very much, for example, by Henry Kissinger and the National Security Council, that they felt that that was something that was very significant and, in fact, formed part of the inspiration for the policy that we know as détente that Nixon initiated. And in particular, what they learned from the French was that they could begin that policy, the resetting of relations in some supposedly non-ideological sphere, technology and science, and that this would be the beginning of a new kind of relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union. And they chose collaboration in space as the beginning point, and that culminated in July of 1975 in the Apollo-Soyuz test project link up between the Apollo and the Soyuz capsule.
Right, yeah, really interesting that there were these various players. And I'm wondering maybe just for the sake of those people not old enough to recall it or maybe who don't know about it, maybe you can describe the significance of that 1975 joint mission and especially that iconic handshake between Alexei Leonov and Thomas Stafford in 1975. I recall it as a seven-year-old child at the time. But what did it mean for people at the time? And do we have a sense for the ways in which ordinary people in different countries reacted to this moment?
Yeah, it was space was the place that in many ways defined Cold War competition. It was the space race as we know it with a kind of shorthand, I think shaped people's consciousness in both the Soviet Union, the United States, and elsewhere around the world. And so there was an excessive sort of extreme nationalization of space science and technology and of space exploration in general. So the idea that these competing superpowers and others such as France would abandon or at least put aside competition for a bit and cooperate was extremely appealing to people. I think it really connected with people, ordinary people. And it occurred against the backdrop of what people were also aware of profoundly, and that was the possibility of the complete and total destruction and annihilation of the Earth as a result of the nuclear policy of mutual assured destruction. So the idea that you could use space technology not to kill people, but actually to bring people together had a kind of emotional appeal that also combined, by the way, with, in general, the emotions that are elicited by seeing the Earth from space that give people this sense of connectedness. And all that produced, I think, a very profound kind of celebration that allowed people to feel a kind of common humanity with others that they had considered the enemy. Now, that wasn't a universal feeling by any stretch of the imagination, but it was one that was quite common, both in the United States and in particular in the Soviet Union. And I should point out here that the one thing that I think that made it more difficult for Americans to understand the appeal of peace was because Americans had not really suffered so much from the horrors of war the way that others, in particular the Soviets, had. The Soviets had a profound sort of memory, a trauma that was inflicted by the mass death of World War II and the Nazi invasion and the nearly 30 million Soviets who died. And Brezhnev himself, as Don Raleigh points out in an article that he published in Kritika, styled himself as a man of peace precisely because of his genuine desire to never have the kind of destruction that happened in World War II. And I think that that desire for peace was manifested, particularly for Soviet citizens, but also for many Americans, in that handshake between Leonov and Stafford, and in general, in the Apollo-Soyuz test project. It signaled for many people the dawning of a new age.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I do think that sense of peace or that desire for peace, it was something that I, when I visited the USSR for the first time in 1988, it was really palpable. And the memory of the war was visible, discernible virtually everywhere. It was only 4 decades earlier, of course, that the war had ended. And I think that's a really important observation about the kind of mentality that the Soviet Union and Soviet people, including Soviet leader Brezhnev, brought to this. I'm wondering, it sounds to me like there's actually really a kind of deeply emotional component. You actually used that word in your previous remarks, an emotional component to this element of collaboration, partly rooted, as you say here, in the issue of trauma, especially on the Soviet side. But it sounds as though also in a kind of awe and excitement rooted in the experience of space flight itself. Can you talk more about that emotional component, what it meant and the role it played in forging this collaboration?
Yeah, that's a another really interesting aspect of the space age and an irony that let's face it, what drove both the United States and the Soviet Union initially into space was a desire to develop intercontinental ballistic missile technology delivery systems for nuclear weapons. But there's an irony that once people actually got into space and looked back down at the Earth, they saw an Earth that was not divided by the lines that we would see on maps that we usually look at. And there was a phenomenon known as the overview effect that was noted by a guy named Frank White. And he interviewed many of the cosmonauts and astronauts and other space travelers. And it was almost as if they had had an aha moment, the sort of LSD moment when they looked down at the Earth and they felt this sense of cosmic connectedness. And for a moment, at least, they seemed to transcend all of their earthly sort of attachments and ways of thinking. And I think it was that sense of transcendence, of looking back at the Earth and being able to feel this connectedness to other people, to other cultures, to bigger things, that made politics as usual seem insignificant and much less meaningful. And that's a very emotional feeling. It's almost a kind of religious born-again experience. There were particular cosmonauts and astronauts, Russell Schweikert in the U.S. case, who definitely had a profound sort of change. They went up into space as cold warriors, as servants of their military-industrial complexes, and they looked back at the Earth and they became peaceniks, or at least they spoke like peaceniks, and I think genuinely many of them did. Edgar Mitchell's another example of that. And on the Soviet side, Alexei Leonov had this incredible sort of transformative moment in 1965 when he was the first person to become a spacewalker, to float in space and to look down upon the Earth. And almost as if, as he described it, he was emerging from the womb or within the womb, within the amniotic fluid, however you want to put it. But it tended to evoke all these very emotional kinds of feelings. And this is something also that many of the psychologists who studied individuals who went into space noted, that otherwise very sort of technical and matter-of-fact people became very emotional and almost lyrical and poetic when they began speaking from space as they gazed down upon the Earth.
Well, that's very interesting. I've never been to space. I can't imagine that I will make it there, although I guess the opportunities are much greater now than they had been in the past. I don't think I command the wealth to be able to do that. But I think it's easy to imagine how seeing the Earth from above would have that kind of, that sort of conversion experience or have that sort of profound effect. But of course, these were the lucky ones, one can say, the people, the cosmonauts, the astronauts that you're mentioning who had the opportunity to be up there and to see the world from up there. And they could, I suppose, describe that experience, translate it, perhaps even alter their behavior upon return. But there was still, I guess, the fundamental question of what is the role of space for these superpowers and even for lesser powers, we'll say, like France. And so to what extent did the different figures involved in all of this regard space as, on the one hand, principally a kind of extension of international politics, that is another arena, if you will, or alternatively as an arena distinct from those here on Earth? And which way of thinking about that problem proved more compelling? I mean, you have the cosmonauts on the one hand, but you also have politicians and statesmen who have, you know, different tasks to resolve, right?
Yes, and of course, the military-industrial complexes that stand behind them. And yeah, it's a very tricky question, a difficult one to answer. I do attempt to answer it in the book, but the way I answer it may sound a bit wishy-washy, but I think it's it doesn't have to be one or the other. That in fact, I think one of the appeals of space exploration as with, let's say, nuclear power is that it can attract a variety of constituencies and supporters. Nuclear power, of course, is something that military-industrial complexes and people that want to develop nuclear weapons will be eager to pursue. On the other hand, it's something that provides the promise of unlimited and, well, at one point at least, people thought clean power, electricity that could fuel a future of abundance. And so you could be very different kinds of people with regard to your political attitudes and whether or not you were a militaristic person, jingoistic or internationalist, but both of you could agree that you could support nuclear power. And I think the same is true of space exploration, is that indeed there is this constant tension in the history of space exploration between, on the one hand, the projection of national priorities and economic and military strategic needs into new space. And on the other hand, the viewing of that new space as a chance for a do-over, a new start. And the tension between these two impulses and the clash between them actually produces the ambiguous and contradictory nature of the enterprise itself. And that continues to this day. You know, just to give you one example, we have, on the one hand, we have these visions of colonizing Mars, of investigating the cosmos, of people coming together and joining together to solve problems that are common to all human beings through space exploration. We have that. But then we have the announcement by Trump and the previous administration to create a new military wing that would be devoted to space, populating space. So we have these competing desires. We see this even, you know, let's look at the former space shuttle program. In any given space shuttle launch, there was the public face of the space shuttle launch, which was presented as civilian and devoted to scientific payloads or to beneficial commercial satellite development, that kind of thing. But then there were the secret payloads that were funded by the Pentagon and the military. Both of those payloads sat side by side on the same missions. The same was true with the Soviet Union and with Russia later on. So I don't think it's the case that one impulse is victorious over the other, but rather they exist simultaneously in a kind of dialectical and dynamic tension. And that is the byproduct of that interaction that produces the space exploration that we get. It, by the way, this is not unprecedented. If we look at the history of exploration, if we look at European imperialism, many Europeans saw the settlement of territory outside of Europe as an opportunity to produce a new kind of world that would abandon the bad old ways of doing things back in Europe. On the other hand, as the Europeans explored new territories, they often brought with them the same old way of doing things that they had thought that they left behind. And the result of those two different tendencies is something really interesting, right? And the same is true of space exploration. By the way, the same is true of internet, of the of cyberspace, simultaneously being colonized by the NSA and by Russian trolls, and at the same time also colonized by those that believe that new kinds of community, human community, and new attitudes that are far more sort of progressive and tolerant can emerge from the colonization of cyberspace. And so it's not one or the other, in my view. It's both in a kind of really interesting and ambiguous and dynamic tension.
Well, and it sounds from what you're saying as though one could say that activities in space by the superpowers is in a sense simultaneously also an artifact of the Cold War in the kind of negative sense, in the sort of confrontational sense on the one hand, and detente is a more sort of positive stage, shall we say, or maybe positive, or an attempt, I suppose, to lessen those tensions. I mean, along those lines, I'm wondering if, you know, maybe beyond what you've said so far, and you've of course said a lot, but I'm wondering if there's a way in which for our listeners you could situate the space collaboration and some of the competition perhaps that preceded it or went alongside of it in the ways that you're just describing. What is its place in the larger history of the Cold War, like say in relation to other episodes, for example, that didn't have anything to do with space? How important of a place does it occupy?
Yeah, well, one of the justifications, as I saw for my research and eventually the book, was that this story of collaboration had been ignored in favor of the story of competition. And I think in part that has to do with the way we narrate things. Mm-hmm. We like stories of competition. We like to turn politics into a kind of game where you have victors, where you have winners and losers. I think zero-sum conceptions of how the world works, where there's always a winner and always a loser, and that you can't be both a winner, something that dominates how we as historians work. And I think that one of the things that I tried to do in this book was to look at the other side, that there are people that see politics not as a zero-sum game, but as a possible win-win situation, and that these forces emerge periodically during the Cold War, and that they played an important role, among other things, in preventing both sides from blowing each other up. I mean, it is astounding if you think about the animosities between the United States and the Soviet Union. If you look at the rhetoric of Reagan about the evil empire, how did we avoid not killing each other? And I think that the reason is because we found ways to work together, whether we liked it or not, right? In part because we had no choice, but also because we did choose peace rather than war. It strikes me that we as historians don't focus enough on looking at those forces that chose peace and collaboration rather than war. And partly, I think, it's because it's not a sexy story. It's just like, you know, if a condominium in Florida, I mean, that's a bad example, I mean, given what's just happened. But when technology works fine, we don't tell that story. It's as it should be. Yeah. It's only when you have spectacular failure that we begin to tell the story. And I think that we need to tell the story of peace. It's boring, right? It's not as interesting as things getting blown up, but it's there. And how does it happen? How do we make peace? And I think that the Apollo-Soyuz test project and the example of collaboration in space, it's merely an illustration of how both sides manage to figure out a way to work together and to avoid blowing up the world. And actually, that's a pretty dramatic story now that I think about it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think you're right. I've long thought that, you know, the tendency, if one thinks about diplomatic history, international relations, I think the tendency has been generally to explain the outbreak of war and not the maintenance of peace. But one could easily begin from the premise that war is the more natural state, and peace is precisely the thing that has to be explained. As much as we may desire peace over war, I think most people do, nonetheless, that may actually be war or conflict may be the more natural state. And explaining peace, I agree that it can be, in a sense, dull or unexciting. It's obviously there's not bombs going off and everything. But I think it's something that does have to be explained. It has to be explained well. So it seems to me like that's a really important contribution of this book. Maybe turning a little bit away from sort of those political and ideological dimensions of the collaboration that you discuss in this book, maybe you can talk about some of the other ones, the other challenges that were actually not of a political or ideological nature, maybe ones that were technical or of different natures. For example, you have a really interesting discussion of the docking mechanism for the Apollo Soyuz. That story proves to be especially curious, although I suppose it has its political and ideological dimension as well. But it seems to me that you're talking about a lot more than just those political and ideological things in this book. And maybe you could tell us a little bit more about some of those aspects.
Yeah, that's a. I think that the way that I've been trained is to, as an historian of technology and of a historian of Russia and the Soviet Union, is to see politics everywhere. But I think it's also interesting to consider those things which are not political. And we often think of mechanisms as fulfilling a utilitarian function that is independent of the political systems that produce them. And I think that that's actually not often true. There's politics everywhere. But at a certain point, of course, you need to have a functioning mechanism in order to have, for example, a docking between a Soyuz and Apollo capsule. You can't simply produce that politically. You have to engineer it and design it. So what I looked at was the process of engineering a docking mechanism that would connect the Apollo and the Soyuz capsule. And it was curious because it started with a very political problem. And the political problem was that both sides, the United States and the Soviet Union, could only come together if they treated each other as equals. The problem with docking, the actual design of docking mechanisms up until Apollo Soyuz, for the most part, is that they involved the penetration of one capsule or flying object by another. In other words, one would have to insert itself into the other. And this felt like a position of domination and submission in the relationship between the two docking parties. So they had to figure out a way to design a docking mechanism that would not penetrate one, the other. And the solution was what they called an androgynous docking mechanism. That is to say, a docking mechanism that did not involve the penetration of one by the other. And instead, it created a sort of clasping mechanism, a kind of hug in space, that produced a neutral territory between the two capsules, a kind of Switzerland in space. And this would allow the two superpowers to connect to each other as equals without having to fear that one would dominate the other. And in this particular case, actually, what I see happening is a perfect kind of seamless combination of the politics of détente, which was based on the notion of equality, and the engineering of a design that would preserve a position of equality between the two capsules and not have one be penetrated by the other. And of course, it would take all male engineering cultures to think of docking in these ways, but they were, in fact, on both sides, all male engineering cultures. And so this docking mechanism actually fulfilled and embodied the idea of détente, whereby the United States and the Soviet Union could engage in a relationship that was win-win rather than one dominating the other, a winner and a loser. Now, the interesting point here, I have a brother who's an engineer, and we talked about this problem of engineering a docking mechanism between the Soyuz and the Apollo spacecraft. And he said, well, I'm not sure that the sexual imagery of penetration and of being penetrated was actually decisive. That in fact, if I was an engineer and I wanted to link up the Soyuz and the Apollo capsule, I probably would end up designing something like what they called the androgynous, neither male nor female, docking mechanism. That they referred to it in those terms is another issue, but that the actual practical problem of how you connect a Soyuz capsule to an Apollo capsule drove the design of the docking mechanism and not anything else. And I think there is probably something to that. It shows that there are limits to politics and that engineering designs and problem solutions can actually be apolitical and in some senses divested of all the baggage of gender and class and race and everything else that we historians constantly look for.
Well, and I think you mentioned in the book itself that we have to remind ourselves these are two capsules moving through space at something like 25,000 miles an hour or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'll just note that an androgynous docking mechanism would be a good name for a rock group or perhaps a softball team, but that could just be me. I'm wondering if this issue of maintaining equality and parity, it sounds as though this was, even leaving aside in a kind of political sense, though clearly in that way too, it sounds as though this was an issue that came up in a number of different ways, or at least it came up very prominently in this particular instance. Were there other moments and other questions about which the issue of maintaining parity and equality also reared its head?
Yeah, there were all sorts of, you know, little things, seemingly little things. Yeah. So, for example, it's a linguistic problem. How do we refer to the Apollo-Soyuz test project? Well, in the United States, of course, we refer to it by putting Apollo first. In the Soviet Union and Russia, it's Soyuz Apollon. So they put the Soyuz first. And that created, I think, a constant sort of challenge to the idea of parity is that the very way that we refer to it. And even if you look at the two crews, the Apollo crew had three members and the Apollo capsule was actually bigger. And the Soyuz crew had two members and the Soyuz capsule was smaller. So this tended to belie the sort of the idea of equality between the two partners. And so those are just two examples, but there are many other examples of where the principle of parity and of equality was violated by the facts on the ground, so to speak. And that made it kind of difficult to figure out how to represent the Apollo-Soyuz test project in a way that was in the spirit of détente.
Yeah,
I'll give you just one example of that to follow up.
Yeah, sure.
So I think that the idea of how do you understand as a layperson the androgynous docking mechanism and its intent to try to equalize the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union, the Apollo and the Soyuz capsule. The Soviets were much better at doing this for the popular consciousness, let's say. And so there was this, the most famous satirical journal, Krokodil, in the Soviet Union, and its Apollo-Soyuz cover had an image of the Apollo and the Soyuz capsule joining together and then squeezing the warrior of the Cold War and killing it right in its sensitive private parts area. And so the idea was that you would have this androgynous docking mechanism destroying the militaristic spirit of the Cold War and then producing a new era after it. The most striking representation of the Apollo-Soyuz test project in the United States was very different, and it came in that magazine called Playboy, which showed a woman being mounted from behind by a man. This was Playboy's representation of the Apollo-Soyuz test project, and the man in this case was the Soviet Union. The woman was the United States. And so the engineering design, the idea of equalizing the relationship between the two and having a coupling that was not a penetration was completely lost on the editors of Playboy and on many Americans, in fact. It's really interesting if you look at the response, the popular response to the Apollo-Soyuz test project in the United States. There was a significant part of the American press that believed that the Apollo-Soyuz test project was basically an instance of the United States getting screwed by the Soviet Union, being dominated by the Soviet Union. And I really found that narrative striking and so very different from any kind of sort of representation of Apollo-Soyuz in the Soviet context. Now, of course, the United States had a relatively free press, and the Soviet press was controlled by the state. But nonetheless, that inability to imagine a relationship of equals was far more prevalent in the United States than in the Soviet Union, both at the level of popular consciousness, let's say, but also at official government levels. And it makes me wonder who really was the aggressor in the Cold War.
Yeah, very interesting. I guess not androgynous enough, apparently, although the docking mechanism was, in fact, androgynous. In light of what you just said, I find particularly interesting a remark that you make in the book. You write at one point, one of the more surprising aspects of cooperation on the U.S. side was that it turned out to be far easier to collaborate with the Soviets than with European allies. It's interesting that that this was true even despite the tendency that you're just describing to, or the inability, more accurately, to be able to imagine a relationship of equals that was present. And yet we still see that the U.S. is able to work with the Soviet Union quite well. Why was the United States able to work so effectively for all of the difficulties and challenges that you've been pointing to, especially in comparison to European allies?
Well, I think that a big reason for that is that the United States turned to its European allies and asked them to pay significant amount of money in order to get rides into space and to cooperate with the United States. So that was one thing that the United States did not demand of the Soviet Union. And in the case of the space shuttle, for example, the United States felt like, well, you know, we've footed the bill for this, and anyone that wants to participate with us in the space shuttle program should pony up, and pony up in a way that will satisfy the American taxpayer and not get us accused of giving away American taxpayer money to perfidious Frenchies and all, you know, French people and all that kind of stuff. In the case of the Soviet Union had its own launch capability. Of course, the European Space Agency did too, but the Soviet Union funded its program separately. So the United States didn't have to worry about voter blowback with regard to this idea that somehow we were footing the bill for the Soviet space program. But that accusation, or at least a fear of that accusation, constantly surfaced with regard to suggestions about enhancing Western European cooperation with the United States. Now, the other problem with the European partners is that they were treated as second fiddles, that they should have to accept absolutely American direction and American guidance, and that they should be in a position of listening to American leadership and following it rather than having their own input and being treated as equals. And so again, that tendency, that American tendency of exceptionalism, of treating the rest of the world as something that should follow its lead and its example, I think that made it very difficult to collaborate with the Europeans, and particularly the French, right? The French had a lot of pride about the value of their technology, the quality of their engineering, the brilliance of their scientists. And they weren't going to accept secondary status with regard to the United States. And I think that's one reason that the French were so eager to work with the Soviets.
Interesting. I mean, another concern that maybe it is related to the issues that you just described are concerns about secrecy and about the loss of technical knowledge. Was there a concern on the part of any of the players, but the Soviet Union and the United States in particular, that in being engaged in this collaboration, they would transfer for a song, a technical knowledge to the other side that was actually best kept secret and in the hands of the United States or the Soviet Union alone.
Yeah, that's I'm glad you mentioned that. That's another key factor. The U.S. fear that if we work with the French or if we work more closely with the West Germans, there are going to be elements who will hand over the technology that they find in the United States in their collaborations with the Soviet Union to the Soviet enemy. And so that fear constantly caused American officials to doubt whether or not it was actually worth risking collaboration with supposedly our allies in Europe, because they might just give away some of that technology knowingly or unknowingly to the Soviets. And so that, yeah, I think that these regimes of secrecy in the United States were creating a barrier to collaboration with the Europeans. And by the way, I do have another point to make about regimes of secrecy. In the U.S. case, it seems that the United States was driven to develop regimes of secrecy because it believed that it was fundamentally superior technologically and scientifically to the rest of the world. So in other words, technological arrogance, a desire to keep our good technology and science to ourselves to prevent it from falling into the hands of the enemy, this is what drove American regimes of secrecy. The Soviet system of secrecy was very different. It was driven not by arrogance, but by insecurity, a fear that if the Soviet Union opened up and revealed openly what it actually was up to, that it would be shown to be technologically inferior and backwards. Of course, the result often was the same, that both sides were incredibly secretive. Although I should point out that the United States, if we think about development of regimes of secrecy, let's say from the death of Stalin up through the end of the Cold War, there is a progressive movement on the part of the United States toward more and more classification. In the Soviet case, even though they're starting from a position of almost complete and total classification, there is a very noticeable trend up through the 1960s, 70s, and 80s of an increasing opening to the world and of a declassification of its technological and scientific infrastructure. And so in some ways, this is counterintuitive, I think, to the way that we often think about the United States and the Soviet Union. The United States was becoming more secretive through the end of the Cold War, and the Soviet Union was becoming more open.
Very interesting. And so that tendency of the American tendency towards classification and security, that was something that really continued throughout the entire Cold War period?
It was, I think, with a brief sort of interlude in the 1970s and under Nixon, but very quickly with the demise of Nixon and then with Jimmy Carter and then the emergence of Cold War II in the Reagan era, the tendency toward classification was, well, there was huge momentum behind it. To the point where American academics in the early 1980s and mid-1980s, before Gorbachev came to power, were increasingly told that if they engaged in conversations at international conferences with their colleagues from behind the so-called Iron Curtain, that they could be accused of giving away national security secrets and arrested or fined for legal technology transfer. And I found that just incredible, you know, not something that we often think about.
Right. No, it's very interesting. And in some ways that actually leads to the next thing I wanted to ask about. And that is, I mean, I think the Apollo-Soyuz mission is the sort of the centerpiece of your book. It's a really dramatic moment. I mean, I certainly recall it from postage stamps and in Russia, there were even cigarettes. But how does collaboration unfold after Apollo-Soyuz? I mean, that's a big moment. What other sort of forms did it take? And I'm wondering if you take a project like Ronald Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, sometimes referred to as Star Wars, was this a complete repudiation of that earlier collaboration? And what happens, of course, with the end of the USSR? Do these collaborations continue, or what happens with them?
It was a dramatic sort of reversal of this movement toward collaboration. And, you know, there was, I think, every expectation on the Soviet side circa let's say 1976, 1977, that the Apollo-Soyuz test project was going to initiate a period of widespread collaboration between the United States and the Soviet Union and the European Space Agency, for that matter, and that that the Soviet Union should gear up and prepare for opening up its formerly very secretive space technology and aerospace infrastructure to the world. The Soviets continued to do that, but contrary to their expectations, the United States did not. And in fact, the United States shut down and became very closed. And I think a key symbolic moment of this was with the celebration of the 10th anniversary of the Apollo-Soyuz test project, in which NASA, driven by the Reagan administration, was told that it should not celebrate in any demonstrative way the 10th anniversary of the Apollo-Soyuz test project. And this was a slap in the face to many of the Soviet participants who were hoping, and I think in Russia, sort of celebratory occasions, right? The anniversaries are really important. And they felt that maybe the 10th anniversary of the Apollo-Soyuz test project would be an occasion in which the United States would try to reinitiate the collaborative efforts that had been put on hold during Cold War II and really intensified after Reagan's famous Star Wars speech. And so that was a kind of a moment where collaborative efforts began to dissipate, but only in the United States. They continued aggressively so in the case of the Soviet Union through the various Intercosmos missions, and then also through the development of the Mir space station at the very end of the Soviet Union, and then after its collapse through the 1990s, when it became a platform for collaborative international ventures of various sorts. And it was at that point in the 1990s that the shuttle people began to get together with the Mir space station people to arrange hookups. And by the way, who was it that participated in those hookups? It was all the characters that had participated in the Apollo-Soyuz test project. Mm-hmm. They came out to reestablish those contacts between the United States and the Soviet Union, and they produced a collaborative relationship through the 1990s that hooked up the Mir with the shuttle space station and laid the foundations for the International Space Station today. So that collaborative impulse continued despite the refusal of the United States to participate for a good chunk of time in the late 70s and early 1980s.
Mm-hmm. Really interesting. I'm wondering, to take a step back, how would you fit the story that you've told here into the larger history of technology? And you're a practitioner of that history, right? With all of its implications for both human welfare and destruction, what place does this story occupy in that history of technology?
Yeah, well, I think of the word safety. Mm-hmm. It's not often that we think about the importance of engineering for safety until, of course, condominiums collapse, right, nuclear power plants explode, shuttles explode. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden we begin to think about the necessity of safety. And what strikes me as important, the place of the Apollo-Soyuz test project in the history of technology, is that it was a rare moment where the center, the focus of the engineering design project was safety. It was actually a safety test. What was it testing? It was testing the ability of two separately designed systems to be able to link up in space in case one of those systems was incapacitated, so that the individuals that were in one capsule incapacitated would have an escape route and could survive. And so the whole focus of engineering was for safety and survival. And so when I think about, and that's very different, of course, from what drove engineering during the space race, that earlier phase, and that was an extreme appetite for risk taking. Mm-hmm. In other words, a downgrading of the importance of safety and design and an enhancement of risk taking. And the idea was that we roll the dice, and if we win, we win big. But if we lose, it could be catastrophic. And instead, we have with Apollo-Soyuz an emphasis on engineering for safety, creating a docking mechanism that can provide an escape hatch. And that was also sort of understood in a broader sense of not only engineering safety for space exploration, but also providing safety in international relations so that the United States and the Soviet Union don't blow each other up. So I think that this is an important moment in the history of safe engineering, secure engineering. And that's an example, I think, that needs to be continually sort of followed, not only in space exploration, but also in the design and construction of all sorts of large-scale technological systems, that putting safety front and center and making it the core design principle, that this is what's needed in order to make the world a more livable and survivable place. So at any rate, that's how I would answer the question about the position.
And it sounds then like basically peace, safety, and security really are represent a kind of major red thread that's running through all of this, I guess, yeah?
That's right. And of course, peace is the goal, and engineering a docking mechanism that allows people to survive a crisis in space is also the goal, and that you could do those two things at once, kill two birds with one stone. By the way, the primary engineer for the androgynous docking mechanism, a guy named Vladimir Sheremetnikov, who died in 2006, he is noted, at least among those who are aficionados of space history and space engineering, as a pioneer in the field of space safety. That his docking mechanisms provided a way to safely link up objects in space that would assure that people could survive in space. And I think that, it's another importance of the Apollo-Soyuz test project is that when you're in space, it doesn't matter what your political, your personal differences are, you have to cooperate if you want to survive. Mm-hmm. You have no choice, right? And so I think that the Apollo-Soyuz test project was a perfect place to sort of test the principle of safe engineering. And to see if people from very different backgrounds and ideological and political systems, educations could come together and solve a problem, right? And Apollo-Soyuz test project proved that they could. It was actually astounding. I think about the current debates about infrastructure projects in the United States, and in some ways it's a kind of the Apollo-Soyuz test project of American politics, bringing radically opposed Democrats and Republicans together on technical problems that they can work together with,
right,
and so that they can transcend their ideological differences. And I think that this is also an example that ASTP, the Apollo-Soyuz test project, provided is a way to project sort of relations between people beyond politics and ideology. And it worked.
Yeah. Well, in fact, you answered the last question that I wanted to ask. I'll ask it nonetheless, and to give you the opportunity to elaborate further if you so choose. But I was going to ask, is the story you tell one of success, and can it serve as a source of inspiration for the future? It sounds as though the answer is very much yes.
Yeah, I think so. I think, again, I'll get back to the point I made about peace being kind of the boring story that maybe for that reason we don't focus on it so much. And one of the reasons I think that Apollo-Soyuz test project doesn't get talked about too much is because it worked.
Yeah.
And it did something. It's not dramatic, like, allowing someone to step on the moon or Gagarin being the first person in space, these kind of dramatic moments. Instead, what it did is that it linked up two capsules in a way that was, it was noticed certainly, and it had a huge impact, but it worked, and it's continued to work, the docking design, the androgynous docking mechanism, all the way on up through to the present. By the way, the Chinese use the basic design developed for the Apollo-Soyuz test project in their linking together of modules for the space station that they are mm-hmm. now populating as we speak. And so I think that's a dramatic indication of the success of the Apollo-Soyuz test project, is that it produced a technology that allowed human beings to come together and work in the vacuum of space. And without it, I don't think that we would be where we are in the exploration of space today.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I would say that as a stamp collector at the time and a seven-year-old at the time. It was a source of great inspiration, I would say. This has been really a great discussion. The book, again, is Collaboration in Space and the Search for Peace on Earth, available from Anthem Press in November of 2021. Thank you so much, Professor Jenks.
Thank you for the great opportunity to talk about my research, as we academics love to do, as I said before. So thanks very much for your questions. This was really fun.
Absolutely. My name again is Paul Wirth, and I'm signing off for the New Books Network. Bye-bye.